Hello and welcome to episode one of a series of podcasts brought to you by the London tax team at Weil, Gottschall and Manges. This episode, the new SSE Good for Geese and Ganders, has the honour of not only being the first tax-related podcast to come from Weil, but is also the first podcast ever to come from Weil, and marks the first instalment in our new Weil on the Move programme. I'm Ollie Walker, a tax partner here in the London office at Weil, Gottschall & Manges, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Stuart Pibworth, an associate in my team.
Hello.
Today's topic is the UK's much-publicised substantial shareholding exemption from corporation tax on share disposals, often referred to as the SSE, and its proposed reform, which, as we shall see, is something akin to an overhaul. And largely, and somewhat unusually in these times, an overhaul which is actually generous to the taxpayer. Now, before we get into the proposals, it's probably worth setting the scene. The SSE was introduced in April 2002 and marked a policy shift by the UK government, allowing UK companies to sell shares at a gain without incurring corporation tax, was largely, and you might say predictably, welcomed by taxpayers. It meant the elimination of double tax on trading profits, once when the profits are realised by the trading company, and then again when the trading company is sold and the corporate shareholder is taxed on the gains. Where there might not have been double tax had the profits instead been paid to the corporate shareholder by way of a dividend. And it's worth noting here that unlike today's generous dividend exemption, the non-taxability of dividends was still jurisdiction-specific back in 2002, which, as we all know now, is contrary to EU law. So the SSE's appearance on the statute books was seen by taxpayers as a good thing, and certainly would have, you know, made the UK a more attractive prospect as a holding company jurisdiction. That being said, there are a number of serious problems with the way the SSE works, which can totally undermine that attractiveness. It's fair to say that the government has now woken up to those problems. As a first step towards reform, the government published a consultation document, or a CONDOC, in May 2016, recognising the issues in applying the SSE and setting out a number of options for reform. Then, in the 2016 autumn statements, it was announced that the SSE would be reformed with effect from April 2017. Draft legislation to implement the reform was then published on 5th of December 2016, and the draft legislation was then itself amended in March 2017. So everything was on course for enactment. But then the Prime Minister called the snap general election and Parliament was dissolved. There are other podcasts available that deal with the political ramifications of that, but from a UK tax perspective, what this currently, and I mean currently as in now, today, the day we're recording this podcast, means is that although the reformed SSE was supposed to take effect for disposals taking place from 1st of April this year onwards, there is no guarantee at the moment that this will be the case. Therefore, the prudent approach is to assume that the new rules aren't yet law, leaving us, quote-unquote, stuck with the existing SSE rules. Stuart, at this point, maybe why don't you take a stroll through those existing rules?
Sure, that makes sense, Ollie. So, under the existing regime, where certain requirements are met, the SSE has the effect of automatically exempting any gain or disallowing any loss arising on the disposal of shareholdings from UK corporation tax. What are those requirements that need to be satisfied? Well, they've mainly fallen into three buckets. The first is what's known as the substantial shareholding requirement. So for this requirement to be met, the investor, which is the terminology used in the legislation, but we would refer to it as the seller, must have held a substantial shareholding, which is broadly 10% of the ordinary share capital, profits available for distribution, and assets available on a winding up in the target company, which the legislation refers to as the investee. That 10% test needs to have been met throughout a 12-month period, beginning not more than 2 years before the day on which the disposal takes place, which is referred to as the qualifying period in the legislation. So In short, what is the test? It's a 10% interest in the target for 12 months in the 2 years prior to the disposal. The second requirement is the investor requirement, so the investor being the seller. So the investor must, one, have been a sole trading company, or if part of a group, a member of a trading group throughout the qualifying period, and two, be a trading company or a member of a trading group immediately after the disposal. And the final condition, the investee requirement, remember the investee being the target, the investee must, one, have been a trading company or the holding company of a trading group or subgroup throughout the qualifying period, and two, be a trading company or a holding company of a trading group or subgroup immediately after the disposal. So when we're looking at the investor and the investee requirements, HMRC's view is that they will not be met, and so the SSE would not be available, where the company group or subgroup, or whatever it is that you're looking at in the context of your transaction, has non-trading activities that amount to no more than 20% of its total activities, excluding certain intergroup and intra-subgroup activities. When you're assessing this 20% test, factors to consider include turnover of the company or the group, value of the assets, staff time and costs, and also the trading history of the group or subgroup.
So actually, it's all really simple, really, really easy. And it does sound simple enough, but actually, in practice, various difficulties continually arise when you actually try to apply the SSE. For example, some investors, sovereigns and pension funds, will never be able to satisfy the investor requirement. You know, they won't be trading as defined for these purposes. It's also often impossible to know whether the SSE would apply in respect of a future disposal due to the various trading definitions, which can seriously influence your day one decision of whether to invest through a UK company or not. A complex, time-consuming, and often costly analysis, in some cases of the entire corporate group, will be required to determine whether the trading requirements are met, even where, from a non-tax layperson, a normal person's perspective, should we say, there may be little or no doubt that the business is trading. Some activities that many people would think should be eligible for exemption won't qualify. For example, the active management of a real estate portfolio by its owner may not qualify. Even if the investor requirement is met for the qualifying period, the requirement to be trading immediately following the disposal can cause practical issues where the disposal proceeds aren't immediately reinvested following the disposal. Now, there are ways to structure around that, but it isn't always possible to do so. And the requirement for the investee to be trading immediately following the disposal puts the SSE's availability for the investor on that disposal at the mercy of factors beyond the investor's control. It's in the hands of the buyer, who isn't, in most cases anyway, isn't in the same group as the seller. So what does the buyer care? So you sometimes see sell contracts imposing restrictions on things the buyer can and can't do to ensure this condition is met.
Yeah, I agree with all of that, Ollie. I mean, in practice, it is a very difficult exemption to apply. Just adding on to what you've just said, it's not just that investor and investee requirements where we've seen practical issues on transactions. We've also seen difficulties applying the substantial shareholding requirement, being that 10% test. Yeah. So take, for instance, where you have an investor that holds a significant interest in terms of the amount invested in the investee, but the 10% threshold is not met. For instance, we've seen it on certain infrastructure investments.
Yeah.
On that fact pattern, even though there's a significant amount invested, the SSE would not apply. And also, we've seen commercial and market restrictions that require partial sell downs of an equity stake. If the resulting rump shareholding is less than 10%, then again, the SSE would not apply.
That's right. I've seen that issue actually rise on IPOs where various trading restrictions have meant that a corporate shareholder has had to expect and plan for a tax hit on its final rump equity sale because it might not have held its 10% for the full 12 months. And actually, when you think about it, now, quite apart from the practical nitty-gritty that we've just gone through, in terms of the more general tax landscape in the UK nowadays, the SSC arguably doesn't sit neatly within the UK corporate tax system anymore. You know, since the introduction of the SSC back in 2002, there have been, you know, fundamental reforms to the UK corporate tax code, including, you know, the introduction of the permanent establishment exemption and the reform of the CFC rules in 2013, and the introduction 4 years before that of an effective exemption from corporation tax on, you know, on the receipts of most dividends by UK corporates. Now, these changes marked a modernisation of UK corporate tax policy, you know, a move from global to a territorial tax system. And against this backdrop, the SSC is an anomaly, I would say, which has resulted in a degree of incoherence. You know, whereas the distribution exemption, which I just mentioned, allows business to plan effectively and provide certainty in terms of financial forecasting, the same cannot be said for the SSC. What is good for the goose will still not necessarily be good for the gander.
You're right, Ollie. I mean, a bit like my music taste, it's you could say the SSC hasn't kept up with the times.
Oh, I've got no comment there.
But do you think that this has had an impact on the UK's competitiveness as a holding jurisdiction?
Well, Stuart, that's a good question. I think that depends on what you're comparing the UK's regime to. For instance, if you just look at perhaps the most obvious comparison, the G7 countries, the US, Japan, Canada, they don't have an equivalent regime and would tax any gains at the applicable corporate tax rates. And, you know, subject to kind of certain requirements being satisfied, there's only a partial exemption in France, Germany, Italy. So arguably the SSC, as it is now, remains competitive. It is, after all, a full exemption from tax.
I think a few points I would probably make on that, though, Ollie. Obviously, I do agree with what you're saying about the SSC being a full exemption. And taking France, for instance, provided that the target isn't a real estate company, I understand that relief is available where the target is booked as a titre de participation in the accounts of the seller. And I understand that's a broader test than trading. And equally in Germany, I understand there's no minimum shareholding requirement, although I understand a 10% threshold is under discussion. There's no required holding period, and the exemption does not turn on the trading status of the seller or the target. And just considering it more broadly than those G7 countries, there are equivalent regimes in across Europe. And I'm thinking of Cyprus, Ireland, Luxembourg, and Netherlands. And when you compare the SSC to those equivalent regimes, I think it does become apparent that the SSC is a little less flexible, particularly when you consider the substantial shareholding requirements and the investor requirements.
Yeah, and that was one of the reasons the UK government published the conduct back in May last year, along with improving simplicity, coherence, and consistency with the OECD's BEPS project. One of the objectives was to address concerns that the SSC was detracting from the UK's attractiveness as a holding company jurisdiction. Stuart, I see you're grasping in your hand the conduct.
Yes.
Could you remind me and the listeners what the options for reform were?
Yeah, sure. So, in order to achieve the stated aims in the conduct, there were five principal options for reform. The first, the comprehensive exemption. So, subject to appropriate safeguards, this was a wide-ranging exemption with minimal requirements as to the nature or activities of the companies involved in the transaction. The second option was an exemption subject to an investee requirement. So here, the option was going to retain the investee and substantial shareholding requirements, but remove the investor requirement. The third option, being an exemption subject to an investee requirement other than trading. So this was an alternative investee requirement, not based on the trading investment distinction that we have currently under the SSC, but using a different type of test. So, for example, an active business test or adopting a whitelist approach, which is used in other areas of the tax code. The fourth option looked at amending the trading test at both the investee and the investor level. So this would be a test that would apply the investor and investee requirements to the seller entity and the target entity only, or retention of the existing requirements with an extended definition of a qualifying activity for the purposes of the SSE. And the final requirement, the final option, was changing the definition of a substantial shareholding. So this would then cover situations where disposals that would not otherwise satisfy the SSE would fall within the scope of the SSE. So kind of picking up that infrastructure example that I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. I think it's actually very clear that option one is the best option in that it goes the furthest in achieving the stated aims of the conduct. Not only would option one increase competitiveness and simplicity, but also be consistent with the broader direction of UK corporate tax policy.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. But not wishing to ruin the end of the story for our listeners, it was clear from the face of the conduct that this was not the government's preferred option for reform.
Yeah, perhaps not that big a surprise. The principal benefit of options two and three is that the investor requirement would be removed. And you know, whilst this approach would allow a broader range of investors to benefit from the SSE, the investee requirement would be retained in one form or another.
Yes, that was the drawback of these options, I agree. Although option three tried to address these concerns, it was not entirely clear whether any of the alternatives to trading would in practice effectively address the difficulties that we've seen in applying the SSE. Option four actually comprised two suggestions. So the first was the investor and investee requirements to be retained, but only for the parties involved in the transaction and not their wider groups. And the kind of second limb of option four would apply an alternative test to trading at the investor and investee level. Option five focused on reform of the substantial shareholding requirement to address practical difficulties arising on disposals of those large, long-term shareholdings, but which did not satisfy the 10% test. Although it was not stated in the conduct, options to address this could have included, for instance, you could have reduced the substantial shareholding threshold to 5%, as is the case in Ireland and Netherlands, or you could have introduced an acquisition cost test, as you've got in Luxembourg and Malta.
Yeah, but that's my attempt to ruin the ending. In the conduct, the UK government was, quote-unquote, generally sceptical of the merits of reforming the 10% test.
But Ollie, all was not lost.
Well, that's a relief.
Indeed. In December 2016, draft legislation came out and was stated to take effect for disposals of shareholdings made on or after the 1st of April 2017. Good news. So, what did the draft legislation say? Well, based on this iteration of the draft legislation, the SSE would be reformed by one, not removing, but modifying the substantial shareholding requirement so that it applies where the investor has held the 10% holding throughout a 12-month period beginning not more than 6 years, rather than the 2 years that we have at the moment, before the day on which the disposal takes place. So basically just lengthen that qualifying period. Two, remove the investor requirement completely. And I think that was the big change when the legislation came out. Removing the post-disposal investee requirement, except where the disposal is to a person connected with the investor. And the final reform in the December draft legislation was the introduction of a broader exemption for disposals by investors owned directly or indirectly by certain qualifying institutional investors, where the investee requirement would not otherwise be met. And in those circumstances, you would only need to satisfy the substantial shareholding requirement, which is itself extended through the introduction of a minimum £50 million acquisition cost test as a possible alternative to the existing substantial shareholding requirement, which this has become known in kind of tax speak as the QII exemption.
So, very basically, in most cases, if a UK corporate seller holds 10% or more in a trading company or a trading group for 12 continuous months during those 6 years, it would not pay corporation tax on any gain arising on the disposal.
Yes, that's right. And I think by extending that qualifying period from 2 years to 6 years, that should avoid the practical issues that you identified earlier about delayed sell downs. And by removing that post-disposal investee requirement as well, where you've got unconnected sales, that will also avoid the need to include the drafting that you referred to earlier in SPAs or other transaction documentation.
Yeah, and you also mentioned this broader exemption for disposals by a certain qualifying institutional investors, the QII exemption. Could you let the listeners know a bit more about that, please, Stuart?
Sure. So the gating point on the QII exemption is, as you said, Ollie, it only applies to qualifying institutional investors. So what is a qualifying institutional investor? Well, these include pension schemes, life insurance businesses, sovereign wealth funds, charities, investment trusts, and widely marketed UK investment schemes. In broad terms, if you fall within that category, if the investor is owned directly or indirectly by one of those entities and the investee requirement is not met, the QII exemption should apply, provided that the investor holds at least 10% of the target being sold or the acquisition cost was at least £50 million. But, Ollie, this is tax. It's not quite that simple. It's a little bit more technical than that. So, working through the legislation in a little bit more detail, where at least 80% of the ordinary share capital of the investor is owned by qualifying institutional investors immediately before the disposal, provided that the amended and modified substantial shareholding requirement is met, no chargeable gain nor allowable a loss would arise on a disposal by an investee by that investor. However, where qualifying institutional investors hold less than 80%, but at least 25% in the investor immediately before the disposal, the amount of any gain or loss arising on the disposal of the investee by that investor would be proportionately reduced to the extent of the qualifying institutional investor's ownership percentage in that investor.
So let's have an example. Let's say a qualifying institutional investor holds, directly or indirectly, 50% of the investor. This means that 50% of any gain on the disposal would be exempt. But if the qualifying institutional investor holds less than 25% of the investor, then the QII exemption would not apply.
That's exactly right, Ollie. So when you're in that situation where you hold less than 25% in the investor, then you would need to consider whether the normal SSE would apply. But that would be unlikely given that the QII exemption only applies if the investee requirement is not otherwise met. Just one thing I should point out on the QII exemption, where a qualifying institutional investor holds the investor indirectly through an entity which is not itself a qualifying institutional investor and is listed on a recognised stock exchange, the QII exemption would not apply.
Okay, so the detail is technical. But this is a positive development, yeah. And it should assist, I think, many qualifying institutional investors. The obvious downside is that it only applies to those certain types of investors. Yeah. So it's fairly narrow, could be wider. It's also slightly curious, I think, that where the investee requirement is met on the normal SSE, the QII exemption should not apply. So the obvious thing to do would be to revert back to the normal SSE, but of course then the more generous acquisition cost test will not help as it only applies to the QII exemption. That just seems a bit odd to me.
Yeah, I think it's a little bit odd, and there has been nothing around the policy reason for that. The only thing that I would say is that the government's response to the Condoc noted that it would continue to monitor the SSE and also just generally consider whether going forwards a comprehensive exemption should be introduced. So you never know what will happen, Ollie.
So you might go back to my option one.
Might do.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed.
I don't think many people are holding their breath. And that certainly wasn't one of the changes to the draft legislation that was subsequently announced in March 2017. It's fair to say that the changes that we most recently saw were, you know, mainly technical clarificatory, with perhaps one exception. Stuart, why don't you let everyone know what the new changes are?
Sure. So these are changes that were introduced to that December iteration of the legislation that we've just discussed. So the first change, and probably the most interesting change, is that the QII exemption acquisition cost threshold has been reduced from 50 million to 20 million. However, this further begs the question that you asked a minute ago, Ollie.
Yeah.
Why only apply the acquisition cost threshold to qualifying institutional investors? Yes. Why doesn't it apply more widely?
I think it's very curious.
It is strange. The second change, it's a bit more technical. So the old rule that the holding period for the whole group can be taken into account where the investor has acquired the investee shares via an intragroup transfer is extended so that it applies even where the intragroup transfer was from a non-UK group company. Third change, the investee will still need to meet the trading test immediately after disposal, even where it's the disposal is to an unconnected third party, if it is a newly incorporated subsidiary to which a trade was transferred intra-group and which would therefore benefit from the SSE. So, for instance, only this would capture hive downs, which we,
yes,
you know, which we often see.
Yes.
The fourth change, as I mentioned in the previous draft legislation, when determining whether the investee was owned by qualifying institutional investors, ownership could not be traced through a non-qualifying institutional investor listed company. This has now been removed but replaced with a provision that denies the special qualifying institutional investor treatment for an investor that is a, quotes, disqualified listed company, close quotes, which is defined as a listed company that is neither a qualifying institutional investor nor a certain type of real estate investment trust. And the final change is that a specific provision will be inserted into legislation that where shares are owned by a partnership, each partner will be treated as owning a proportion of the shares equal to their partnership sharing ratio.
On the whole, Stuart, I think these are positive developments,
yeah,
a few useful technical tweaks and a helpful reduction in the acquisition cost threshold, but you know, we're lawyers. Is this the law? The draft legislation was stated to take effect for disposals arising on or after April the 1st, 2017, but there was simply not enough time to get this through Parliament before Parliament was dissolved ahead of the snap election. So it was never enacted. And I should say, this isn't the only thing out there that we're seeing stuck in limbo.
Yeah, I think that's right, Ollie. But whilst that is the case, I think it is correct to say that we're still expecting it to become law. I don't think we are expecting the government to reverse its position on this.
Well, certainly not. This will almost certainly become law, and I expect that it will probably still take effect from the date that was stated, April the 1st this year. But we can't rule anything out.
And so I guess at this stage, the advice seems to be that taxpayers should apply the unreformed SSC to a disposal to determine whether the conditions are met. And if the conditions are not met, it will then simply be a case of reassessing the position as and when the SSC is officially reformed. So in the meantime, I guess taxpayers would need to think long and hard and seek advice from their advisors before relying on the reformed SSC exemption where they cannot avail themselves of the unreformed exemption.
I would advise UK corporate taxpayers who are in that position to monitor developments, which we will also do, of course. In the meantime, that's the end of the podcast. You have been listening to the new SSE, Good for Geese and Ganders, episode one of our While on the Move series of podcasts. Please keep an eye out for the next episode. And until the next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.